This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Community Radio, also simulcast on KEPW.org. I do try to bring you lectures and interviews from groups against state-sponsored corporatism. And during the deforestation disease, I'll be recording from, right now you're hearing the echo from my house, and I try to bring you stuff from a sustainability perspective. I've studied sustainability and experimented with it for about over 30 years, and so of course I couldn't get a job in that during the financial crisis because, and you shouldn't make money off of that anyway. So I've been driving truck, so that gives me a little bit of a balanced, semi-balanced perspective, give you the other side a little bit, try to help you use your brain, think for yourself, practice critical thinking. None of the opinions on this show are that of the management, the producers of KEPWLP, or Eugene Peaceworks et al. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media.
Has been unwavering, and he has stood with us through thick and thin. We greatly appreciate him joining us today, and I'm going to ask all of you to give a huge welcome to our friend and champion, Peter DeFazio. Thank you. Okay.
I can't tell you how great it is to be here today. I am so tired of Zoom conferences, Zoom fundraisers, Zoom hearings and markups. It's great to be here with real folks, and I really appreciate the invitation. You know, the conference, as we're meeting now, you know, we're still in a time of uncertainty for the future of transit. You know, COVID rates are higher than we'd like, and, you know, many workers are still working remote. Employers are making decisions, predicting ridership and, you know, traffic patterns weeks out or even months out has obviously got to be a real challenge for you. I know how hard it's been for transit agencies, workers, suppliers in the past year and a half. You've weathered massive ridership declines, new demands on your budgets. Transit workers have been on the front lines, risking their own safety to keep us moving. Tragically, we've lost at least 545 transit workers to COVID during the pandemic. We owe them and their families a debt of gratitude, along with a renewed commitment to worker safety. The pandemic has highlighted something that everyone in this room already knew. Transit's essential. Millions of frontline workers, doctors, nurses, grocery store workers, first responders have relied on transit throughout the pandemic to get to their jobs. Transit vehicles have been used to deliver groceries, medicine to homebound individuals. Some cases were even used to provide Wi-Fi to students without internet access at home with the schools closed. Many Americans took transit to access vaccine clinics, which was particularly crucial for rural and suburban Americans who had to travel long distances and didn't have access to a car. In some cases, transit facilities or transit buses themselves were used as vaccine sites. For all that the transit provides to our communities, it's important for Congress to step up and support you. The Democratic Congress, in partnership with the Biden administration, is on pace to deliver record-breaking support for transit. I was very proud to work closely with APTA in making the case for the COVID relief funding. The $30 billion that passed through the Transportation Infrastructure Committee as part of the American Rescue Plan without a single Republican vote, combined with the nearly $40 billion from two prior appropriation bills, was and is an investment in keeping our communities moving, keeping riders and workers safe. These funds will help cover the holes in your operating budgets, emergency spending for the next several years. But we need to look to the future. Even prior to the pandemic, transit agencies were struggling with a backlog of over $100 billion to bring your systems up to a state of good repair. And even as we work to better maintain our existing assets, it's important to expand transit service to more areas, increase frequency of service, help more Americans get out of the cars. You are a big part of the fight against climate change, and also will substantially help mitigate congestion to avoid the need to build more highways. The bipartisan infrastructure bill will do a lot to meet those investment needs. I've been pretty clear about it. It's not the bill that my committee wrote. You know, we went through a real legislative process, many hours in committee, hundreds of amendments, hours on the floor, amendments on the floor, but the Senate did not go through a legislative process. But we set the bar. We set it high. They came in lower in transit, they came in lower in rail, they came in a little bit higher in highways, but they also left out some of the critical policies that were in our bill. But there are ways that we will be dealing with that through the Biden administration and perhaps through the Build Back Better. This bill increases transit levels to record amounts, increases funds for the State of Good Repair Program, bus facilities program by nearly a third in the first year, which will help us start reducing our maintenance backlog. $8 billion in one-time guaranteed funds for the Capital Investment Grant Program, which will help bring new transit service to more Americans. Increases funds for urban, rural paratransit programs by 30% in year one, which will allow transit agencies of all sizes to better serve their riders and meet maintenance needs. Increased funding is an essential part of transit's path forward, and the bipartisan infrastructure bill will deliver on that, but it's not the only part. We need to pair increased funding with the right policy choices. That includes an emphasis on the conversion to zero-emission fleets, a rejection of continued efforts by big oil to secure subsidies to prop up a dying industry that's killing the planet. That means a focus on equity, not as an afterthought, not to check a box, but a meaningful improvement in access and quality of life for all Americans. That means a recognition that every transportation decision is also a climate decision, the decision about how to prevent and mitigate the catastrophic events of climate change we're already seeing today. And that's why it's so essential that we pass the Build Back Better Act. It's not the total solution, but it is a big step toward the policies that will help us build a better future. The bill includes $10 billion for transit through a new affordable housing access program. This is novel. It does not fall afoul of the president's double-dipping pledge. This would provide expanded transit service and funds to be administered jointly by the Federal Transit Administration and Department of Housing and Urban Development, a unique approach we've never taken before in authorizing a transit program. That partnership will ensure that selected projects will expand access to affordable housing, education opportunities, and meaningful employment. The program is focused on disadvantaged communities, low-income neighborhoods, persistent poverty communities, who often have the residents most in need of transit service and access to affordable housing, but they're too often left behind when route and planning service decisions are made. Funds will go to build new bus lines, rail lines, expand transit service to areas that don't have it now, increase the frequency of service, purchase zero-emission buses, rebuild transit facilities, support research, development, workforce training. Unlike traditional funds, these funds will be available to cover operating costs in addition to capital expenses. They'll also be available up to a 100% federal share, which will allow us to deliver projects more quickly. I encourage all of you to advocate with your elected representatives, the House and Senate. It will be passed only by Democratic votes, but if we can lessen some of the Republican opposition, particularly in the Senate, when they go through one of their crazy votoramas, that'd be great. So, be strong advocates. Talk about the benefits to the state or to the region that's represented by someone in the House, the district. I'd also encourage you to ensure that you're talking to your elected officials regularly, not just about this legislation, but to keep them apprised of the important role transit plays in their communities. Transportation has long been one of the more bipartisan issues in Congress, but that hasn't always held true when it comes to transit. Some members still hold the outdated view that transit's a luxury rather than a necessity, or that transit's only important for the big cities that they don't represent. Nothing could be further from the truth. Transit is the lifeblood of our cities, but it's also a lifeline for our small towns. All of America, rural Americans deserve to have mobility options. Small city residents deserve to have mobility options and clean air just as much as those in our big cities. And while transit operations in rural communities may look different than transit in major cities, it doesn't make it less valuable for those who depend on it. So particularly for those that here that represent small, urban, rural transit systems, who are represented by members who are skeptical of transit, I encourage you to keep trying to talk to your elected officials. I know it's not an easy lift. I have to deal with these people. But it's important to hold accountable the people who represent your ridership. It's also critical we continue to source more of our rolling stock and transit equipment domestically. I got on the floor for a while today. I was thrilled with what I saw out there with advanced transit technology made in America. And the suppliers here today, we're sending a signal to them. There's going to be a lot of business for you. If you're going to make major capital investments, build plants, you've got to know that the business is coming. Well, the business is now coming. We're putting up the money. The business is coming. You know, America has underinvested in transit for years. The bills enacted and being currently are a major step in turning the tide. There are significant opportunities for companies to use American goods, employ American workers, and I'm going to continue to fight to strengthen, close the last loopholes in the Buy America standards. Unfortunately, the Senate refused to put theirs into their version of the bill, but we have other ways to enforce those things. Lastly, I'd like to encourage you all to keep innovating for the future. As transit ridership begins to grow, now is the right time to rethink service, routes, frequency, to ensure our systems are ready to meet today's and tomorrow's challenges. We're seeing great examples across the industry that includes new technologies participating in this year's APTA Expo. It includes Champaign-Urbana, who's not only launching hydrogen buses, but is producing their own green hydrogen using solar power. That's incredibly exciting. It includes WITA in San Francisco, testified before our committee in September that their ferry ridership nearly doubled overnight after they reduced fares and provided better service to working class communities. They rethought their business model, and it's provided tremendous benefits. Kansas City, where they've launched a zero emission and zero fare service, helping to tackle climate and equity concerns together. The path forward is going to look different at every one of your agencies, that's for certain. But it's incumbent on all of us to be bold in confronting the challenges we face, the threat of climate change, the need to build a more just and equitable society, the need to support reliable family wage jobs for our workers. Transit has a central role to play in meeting all of those challenges, and I look forward to working with all of you to ensure our transit systems come back better and stronger and appropriate to the 21st century and the challenges of the 21st century. With that, Dorval, I'd be happy to take a few questions from folks.
Rain on me.
Yep. Okay.
Sure.
You know, first of all, before I sit down, can we all stand up and give another applause to the chairman here? Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for those words and thoughts, and I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and then we'll also open it up to the audience. I know your time is limited, so we're going to try to move things along here as much as possible. You talked about the bipartisan infrastructure bill, and you certainly have indicated that you didn't get everything that you had looked for as part of your vision for the Invest Act. But it certainly includes some of the elements that you included in your vision, like significant increases in transit and passenger rail. What elements of the bipartisan bill are most important to you?
Well, the number one thing is the funding levels. Again, their transit levels and rail levels are lower than mine. We hope with this new novel program to get closer to the numbers I had. So that's incredibly important. It does include measures that will help people move toward zero emission buses. There is a provision in there saying a quarter of the money has to go to fossil fuels vehicles. We'll just see. That might just somehow fall off the cutting room floor somewhere over there at DOT, and then we run out of money. So those are very important provisions. They did include some money on equity. I'm going a lot bigger on the equity issues to rejoin communities and that. The most important thing is the record level of spending.
No, I think we're all in agreement on that. It's at a historic level, one that we've never experienced in my time in this industry. And I know that there's also, as you're pointing out, an expectation that we are going to move aggressively to spend that money and to start to create the benefits that you mentioned in your remarks. And I think it's fair to say that we're all out here are committed to doing that and making your vision turn into a reality in a way in which we move forward with these programs. Your extraordinary efforts have also resulted in $10 billion for public transit and $10 billion for high-speed rail in the Build Back Better Act. Something else that is, in my opinion, amazing given the way that bill has been trimmed down from where it started at the very beginning of that process. You talked about this a little bit, but I wanted to give you a chance to expound on a little bit more. What is it that we can do to really try to get this bill across the finish line and make that portion of your vision a reality?
Well, it's going to be a challenge. There's a few people in the House who have now sort of pledged to vote for it, a few Democrats, but they could probably use a little reinforcement. I'm pretty sure the list is out there. The Senate side, obviously, is going to be much more challenging as they go through their bizarre process called a Votorama on limited amendments. Any one Democratic defection could knock something out. So we need to be focused. All of us need to be focused on all the Democrats in the Senate, and particularly those who might be skeptical about transit or high-speed rail or any of the other provisions in that package. That's why I'm urging people to, you know, be engaged. I was talking to one of the manufacturers, and I won't mention which senator, but he was talking about how much that senator's state would benefit from this a proposed high-speed rail project, mm-hmm. Who might be reluctant about the additional money. So those are the kinds of things we need to target and talk up to people.
Absolutely. You know, look forward to trying to do that as well. At this point, we are going to open it up to the audience and give you all an opportunity to ask the chairman some questions. We have people staged throughout the floor here who can come up to you and give you a microphone. So do we have anyone who has a question here? Yes.
Thank you very much for taking my question, and thank you for coming, Congressman. I wanted to ask you about disabilities and the way transit authorities approach serving disabled customers. One of the things I've noticed out on the show floor is if you look at all the buses, about half the footprint is set aside for wheelchair usage. And I'm a frequent transit customer. I have been my whole life. They're almost never used. Is there a more common sense way, rather than requiring all that square footage that Congress could do, I believe it's part of the Americans with Disabilities Act, to serve our disabled Americans without taking up all this space on the buses that is almost never used? Is that something that Congress has ever thought about?
No, I'd say that's kind of a novel question. I didn't know that the federal standards were that prescriptive. I know, you know, we had to provide access, but I didn't know that they had like a square foot requirement or anything like that. And on a number of the vehicles I visited, some of the space was easily converted between a wheelchair and or you know, regular. I think there's ways that we can deal with that innovatively, you know, that we should both have, I'll have my staff look at how prescriptive the federal regs are and see, you know, how we can continue to serve those people properly, but also not unnecessarily, you know, bump other people off the bus when it isn't being used, and that could be also something on the manufacturer's side to figure out ways to make those sections, okay, you got a wheelchair on, it's gonna look one way, but you can quickly convert it. It can either be a standing space with a strap easily, because these all fold up, or something else so that you aren't losing space on the bus. But first time I've had that question. We'll have to look into it.
Thank you. Question over here.
Good morning. Obviously, this is going to have an enormous impact on jobs and the workforce across the country, and I know that that's a critical part of the funding. Can you talk about the ways that you hope to see transit agencies implement uses of the funding that will specifically grow jobs for the country?
Well, that's where I talked about the idea of extending service into communities that haven't had good service. I mean, I've talked to members in the LA Basin where people have to change buses four times to get to a downtown job, and the commute is just draining and expensive and takes a very long time. So part of the intention of both the affordable housing section is to look at problems like that and provide better access, because we're going to need a bigger workforce. We're going to need a new workforce. There's a lot of workforce training in the legislation, part of the legislation coming out of the education and labor community. We're looking at reaching communities who haven't had access to good, high-paying jobs. They don't necessarily have the skills or the training, but we're going to put in place programs that can train them up, can get them into these jobs. LA has set up a residential high school because there's a lot of kids who live in, they're basically homeless sometimes without parents, for young men and women that is oriented toward transit, that their jobs would be, they're either going to be operating side or they're going to be potentially maintenance side, developing them into a vocation at the high school level. And we'll be setting up things like that, hopefully, around the country that will train that new workforce. And then a lot of this workforce is probably going to live in areas that isn't well served. So we get them trained, they still got to get to work. So that's part of my intention with the new joint program between HUD and the FTA.
Thank you. I was making a point earlier in the week about the conversation that you're having about combining housing and transit is really completing the circle of the history of FTA and UMTA, which, as you know, started in housing as a housing program, and then eventually, moved forward into the transit world. But connecting us up is really going back to our roots, which was, I think, the reality of how, when the program was first started, you understood that there is a direct connection between housing, urban development, and public transportation. And so I think in some ways you're just reamplifying that connection all over again. So kudos for you on that. Do we have any other questions? I see we have one right over here. Okay, and I see one over there. I'll get to you next.
Carlton Christensen with the Utah Transit Authority. In your original legislation, there were some earmarks submitted by members of Congress. What happens to those? Do you see them having any second life?
We spent, and my staff spent, an incredible amount of time working with members, vetting the earmarks. We set very stringent parameters, criteria, because of the past concerns, back more than a decade ago, about how some of that money was designated and spent. Actually, when I was writing the service transportation bill in Obama's first term, I had already adopted this approach and had over 400 members submit projects that had to be publicly posted, they had to be vetted, they had to show they had community support, that they were consistent with the state STIP, not necessarily funded by the state STIP, all those things. None of that was posted. I mean, he killed the transportation bill, but Obama. But then they were posted until we lost the House, and there were no scandals. Same thing here. These were all posted, all vetted, And they were meritorious projects. I mean, whatever state you live in, you know, I live in Oregon, you know. The people in Salem don't necessarily, when they get their huge allocation money from the federal government, they don't necessarily know a specific need that's really important in your district that they're never gonna get to in their five-year plan. Or the bureaucrats in Washington. I mean, I'd say to the Republicans, why do you want to do away with designated spending and have all the bureaucrats make all the decisions about where the money goes? That doesn't make sense to me as an elected representative. So we had, I think, well over 100 Republicans and most of the Democrats submit projects. I tried very hard to keep them in the bill. Unfortunately, Senate parliamentarian, the Senate is just totally a ridiculous place. I mean, they are vetting things under a rule written by a senator who's been dead for 12 years, that was written 28 years ago, that are being interpreted today by a parliamentarian who never knew him or met him on what he meant and what can be in and out of bills. And there was no way we could find to get past the Senate parliamentarian and the objection of Senator Robert Byrd from the grave. So I've talked with appropriations and others. We're trying to find some way to at least save part of that. You know, and the Senate always takes care of themselves. So they'll be getting theirs. So we'll see. I haven't totally given up yet, but it's a rough road.
Thank you. And I think we have time for one last question, so go ahead.
Chairman DeFazio, thanks so much for being here. Kevin Corbett, the head of New Jersey Transit, and you certainly saw the impact when the ARC tunnel was killed. Thanks for your support. I think you just saw with Governor Murphy, President Biden. 2 weeks ago, we had our first major project, our largest project in our history, the groundbreaking for the Portal North Bridge, part of the Gateway program, our first step. And thank you tremendously for your support on that. But my question comes, what we learned a bit from that was working with FTA and FRA on the most positive, friendly terms, but because of a lot of the history of FTA and FRA regulations, legislation, there really is an effort, and Secretary Buttigieg, Nuria Fernandez, FTA, Amit Bose, both were here yesterday, really looking at harmonization, because with the billions of dollars that we have coming at us, we have to look how we can deliver projects, you know, very effectively, otherwise we're afraid there won't be a second bite at the apple. So the question is, that harmonization effort to really streamline DOT processes, they're working on that as a task force at DOT, but I think some of that's going to involve legislative fixes. And is that an awareness on the T&I committee, and do you think that there's the support, or what do we need to do to get the support to really allow that to really streamline the processes for us?
Well, there is a provision in Build Back Better called One Federal Decision, which would greatly accelerate projects and would deal with a good part of that. I'm not know that it deals with all of it. But remember, the Portal Bridge and the tunnels were held up for political purposes. It wasn't that they couldn't process. I mean, the environmental impact statement for the tunnels sat somewhere on Elaine Chao's empty desk for 3 years or so. That's another problem that has to be dealt with or has been dealt with for now. We got to hope for a future that we don't get back there. I think that the one federal decision will take care of most of the concerns about the lengthy delay. Part of the problem is you get agency, because it's that's maritime. You have to bring in the Coast Guard, okay? Because it's a bridge, and we had something like this in Portland with a major bridge over the Columbia River, and I said, I started asking quite early on about questioning the project, and I had issues, and one of them was, what about shipping? And the Coast Guard wasn't involved in the process till near the end. They said, wait a minute, we got this manufacturer who makes these really big things, and they won't fit under this new bridge. And so then the state said, well, we'll build them another factory downstream. No, I mean, it's like, we've got to get this stuff right at the outset and get everybody at the table, bang heads if necessary, and get it done. I mean, I'll give a quick story. My first term in Congress, Ronald Reagan had vetoed the service bill. I was the most junior member of the committee. I went to Bob Rowe and said, you know, could I get something in this bill? And he sent me, I can't remember, chief of staff was a very intimidating guy, Sullivan, I think his name was, gigantic guy. And he's like, oh, yeah, I guess you can do that, that'll be okay. So I got some money for a project I knew that was stalled because it was a joint city, county, state project to do at least the design and you know work on that. And I remember the consultants were saying, Gene, saying, oh, you're going to be a hero. I said, no, you don't know Eugene. I said, this will become controversial. Ultimately, it did. They proposed a 6-lane bridge in Eugene. They had to have a referendum. They voted that down. So ultimately, they built the bridge. They did the earthquake reinforcement. They did improve traffic throughput with on-ramps, off-ramps, safety for bicyclists. But then they had money left over because I'd gotten the more money for the bigger bridge, and so they built a bike bridge next to it, which they named after me. So anyway, that's how these things work out sometimes.
Well, thank you, Chairman DeFazio. We greatly appreciate your leadership and your time today. And I would like for us all to give the chairman another huge round of applause for his support in transit. Thank you so much.
And on that side too, could you just sit down so that's... Thank you. Thank you. You probably know it's one of the trilogy albums inspired by Salvador Dali painting called The Endless Enigma.